Welcome back. Today is going to be a heavy episode, just fair warning, because we're going to be talking about what's going on in Kenosha. The thing that really struck me is I wanted to know more about the narrative I'm seeing that Jacob Blake was shot by police because he was Black, and that Kyle Rittenhouse walked right past police after committing two murders and was not arrested because he was white. And I really wanted to see what the surrounding circumstances and facts are behind that and dive into that narrative a little bit deeper. So we're going to talk about the facts, we're going to talk about the surrounding circumstances, and we're going to talk about where we are now. Let's get into it.
Hey there, this is Get Legit Law and Shit, and I'm Emily D. Baker, badass lawyer for online business. I've been a licensed attorney for over 15 years, and I'm a former prosecutor. So yeah, I know some shit, and we're going to talk about the legal shit you need to know. But don't worry, this is not another boring business podcast. So let's get started.
In talking about what's going on in Kenosha and the civil unrest, the protests, the anger, the rage, we have to talk about the circumstances surrounding two very different outcomes, if you will. And to do that, I'm going to talk about what led up to the Jacob Blake shooting, what was going on, or what we know of what was going on with Kyle Rittenhouse, and then kind of talk about where we are and where we go from here a little bit, which is my opinion. I try to share facts in an unbiased and neutral way. As always, all of the resources that I have pulled information from are publicly available and will be in the show notes of this episode. That said, I still am a former deputy district attorney, so I do have ingrained opinions, thoughts, and experiences. And when one of my opinions, thoughts, or experiences leads me down a certain road, I will tell you why and where that's coming from. It is one of the things I believe most strongly in, that your opinion is yours and you are entitled to it. You are entitled to voice it or to not, share it or not, but that you should be given the facts to make your own opinion and your own decision. And that's where conversation is so important, because a lot of our opinions and perspectives are informed and colored by our life experiences. And this is something I learned about very much in the fine art of jury selection. As a criminal prosecutor, I frequently was in jury trials. And in jury selection, if you've never been on a jury, it's a fascinating experience. I understand that during COVID, that would be a horrific experience. Like, the last place I want to be during a global pandemic is a criminal courthouse, because they are incubuses of the plague. You have people coming in and out who have been in custody. Custody populations tend to have disease run through them the way cruise ships do. Not to make light of what it's like to be in custody or compare the two. I'm just saying close quarters, shared bathrooms, shared food. In my time, I've had colleagues end up with MRSA, staph infections from courthouses. I was exposed to tuberculosis, which led to a very long treatment and subsequent health issues. I've had colleagues exposed to just about everything you can imagine. There was a huge measles outbreak in LA County. These things happen because of close proximity and conditions, but the courthouse is not where I'd want to be during a pandemic. Also, jury selection, those jury boxes are tight. Like, those chairs are little. I would sit in them sometimes waiting for different courtrooms, and I'd be like, oh my God, the sides of this chair are just squeezing my butt. So now you've got jurors that are uncomfortable, that are missing work, that don't want to be there in the first place, and in some cases are concerned for their own personal safety, depending on the nature of the case. Because let me tell you, if you sit on a jury on a gang-related murder in Los Angeles, it might make you feel a little uncomfortable to learn all the shit that's going on not so far from where you live. So, the fine art of jury selection. If you've never done it, you inquire, or the lawyers, the judge, inquire about your underlying biases, and not in a negative way, but a hey, are all your family police officers? Hey, are all your family members had negative interactions with the police? Hey, do you feel a certain way that might make it hard for you to just listen to the facts, listen to the law, and then apply the two? Because that's really the job of the American jury, is to listen to facts, listen to what the law is, not decide what the law is, listen to what the law is, and say, do these facts mean this thing happened or didn't happen? That's the job. And then the judge determines sentencing. So in jury selection, you get to talk to a lot of people for days sometimes, depending on which court you're in, for days of jury selection. And you get to hear, especially this I loved about being a lawyer, you get all the tea. So if you've ever been in a courtroom and you've seen people go sidebar, or go back into the hallway, that's where you get the tea. And you get to hear all of the things people have experienced in their lives that might make them feel a certain kind of way. Someone who witnessed a parent being robbed in their small business is going to feel some kind of a way if it's a commercial burglary case where somebody came in and robbed a 7-Eleven at gunpoint. It's going to be very hard for them to put their personal experience aside. Either way, this is why conversation is so important. And as I was researching and contemplating this episode, which I do, all episodes get mulled around in my brain for quite a while. As I was contemplating this episode, and we're going to get into it, I promise. One of the things that really struck me is how difficult it's gotten to have conversations in public forum. Social media is hard to do this anyway. But how nervous people are to have conversations and share differing beliefs because, and I talked about this a little in the episode about Britney Spears, and I've talked about this in other episodes, because of the overriding feeling that if somebody disagrees with you, they're going to want to like end you or cancel you. And we're seeing some of this come out in the protests in Oregon. A gentleman who might have had ties to some like pro-Trump movements and more conservative movements was shot and killed. And a lot of the protesters were like, good, it's one less. And there's a couple videos floating around on social media saying, I don't care. We don't care that he was killed. And if people are cheering, like, you disagree with me, so you should die, we've come a very, very quick, long way down a rabbit hole that is very, very concerning to me. Either way, this conversation here is a safe space. This conversation here is meant to explore the facts from all sides and allow you to come up with an opinion that you can share or not. The problem with social media on a whole is this like keyboard warrior, you should fucking die if you disagree with me kind of comment that is now spilling out into the streets. And that concerns me. On all sides, like on all sides. I don't care if your viewpoints are left, right, center, purple, pink, brown, blue. I don't care. What I care about is that we as a human race don't turn on each other and say, you disagree with me and therefore you should end. That concerns me greatly because I really do believe we went over this in law school so much. Is really getting comfortable with the uncomfortable concept of the First Amendment, which is you have a right to say basically whatever, and you should be safe in the right to say basically whatever. And those of us who believe as Americans in the First Amendment should believe in the right to speak in support of my beliefs and the right to speak in opposition of my beliefs. And we have to hold those two viewpoints equally. And sometimes it's really, really hard to do, to hear someone saying something that you hate and just be like, but you have the right to say it. So getting into all of that, those are the things that I was contemplating while talking about this, because I have found the media narrative to be so spun up, especially in the contrasting of these two events. And that pisses me off because I think people are angry. I think people are rightfully frustrated. I think people are rightfully calling to evaluate the systems that leave it where a lot of Americans, especially in our Black communities and Latino communities, don't feel safe to call the police. And when you look at something like Jacob Blake, you can see why. Jacob Blake's ex-girlfriend called the police. She's the reporting party in this, you know, the RP in this. She called the police. The backstory on that is that he had broken into her home and sexually assaulted her earlier in the summer, and charges were filed in July. It seems that, and all of the news media keeps saying he wasn't supposed to be there. No one will just come out and say there was a restraining order, but knowing the way that sexual assault and domestic violence prosecutions work, I can't imagine that there's not, and I would be shocked if there wasn't, but none of the news outlets have said that there's a restraining order. But all of the news outlets have said, and the 911 call indicates that he was not supposed to be there. I imagine it's because once the charges were filed with the break-in, the domestic violence, the sexual assault, and a bunch of other stuff, that there was also a restraining order, a protective order for her to keep him out of the house. So he broke in, took her car keys, wasn't supposed to be there. She called the police. This is a not uncommon domestic violence scenario. This is a case scenario that I've read more than a few times. The stealing of the car particularly, which always pissed me off. I was like, dude, if you had beaten me and I had gotten to the point where I had gone to the police to deal with the domestic situation, and then you try to steal my fucking car, the rage. I would have all the rage. just not to make light, but I would have all the rage. So I understand why the reporting party in this situation called the police. There's a restraining order. Restraining orders are there to protect you. DV is notoriously volatile, notoriously violent, and there are more than a few instances in my own experience that I can think of off the top of my head where people have gone right through restraining orders and committed atrocious acts and murders. Not to sound like a country song, but if you haven't listened to Goodbye Earl, it's a great country song addressing domestic violence by the Dixie Chicks, who are now just the Chicks. It's another conversation for another day. But anyway, I understand where reporting party is coming from. I've had conversations like this with reporting parties, like this with victims dealing with the fear of violence. I've also gone through some police FATS trainings, other types of lectures, and have always been surprised, I guess, to see the statistics of injured officers and officer-involved altercations when responding to domestic violence situations. Here's my opinion on that. I think if you've gotten to a point where you are angry enough to assault those that you love, that you don't give a fuck who else gets assaulted in that process because you are already so angry. Like when you've already lost control of yourself, that you're beating on people that you love, that's already a volatile situation the police are coming into. So it's known that domestic violence calls are precarious for officers because of the heated emotions going into it already. So that's what officers arrived into. They knew that he had a warrant out for the July filings. They knew that this was a domestic call. And I believe that they knew that he might have a weapon. And normally 911 will ask, does he or she have a weapon? And we'll be told either yes, no, or maybe. So then police get on scene. It seems that things went very quickly south. And again, this is already a heated situation. Police gave orders. They were likely just going to arrest him on the warrant because that's the easiest way to resolve the situation. You're not supposed to be here. There's an outstanding warrant. We can take you out of the situation and then we're done. He fought with police. One of the police officers ended up in a headlock. He was tased twice and still didn't comply. So the videos, which I have watched, I do not recommend that. Because if you haven't had to go there, you don't have to go there. It's truly heartbreaking. And I know some will disagree and they'll disagree, but it's heartbreaking on all sides. I know Jacob Blake didn't want to go into custody. I believe that officers don't go onto a call intending to get into a use of force or to shoot somebody. It's not what they want to do either. So it's heartbreaking on all sides. When you see the videos again, you know, warnings have been given because this is caught from multiple angles on cell phone video. You see the officers giving instructions. You can't hear them giving instructions. You can see them giving instructions. You see that they're drawn down. They've got their guns very clearly pointed on him. And he goes all the way around the SUV and reaches into the driver's side. Now, from my experience as a district attorney, that's when somebody can reach for a weapon and officers' lives can be endangered. So at that point, does an officer choose to wait and shoot or shoot immediately? It's going to depend on the department training. It's also going to depend on all the surrounding circumstances. The surrounding circumstances have indicated that he had a knife. At what point the officers knew that is not clear to me yet, but the actions of the officers indicate they believed he was reaching for a weapon, because otherwise you don't start shooting somebody. Keeping in mind that a car can also be used as a weapon against officers, I've worked cases like that. They're awful. But this whole thing is tragic. However, Jacob Blake also put himself in that situation because he had an outstanding warrant, because he had a restraining order, and because he wasn't supposed to be at that location in the first place. If he hadn't gone to where he was restricted from going, the police would not have been called on him. So while when I look at the George Floyd case, and I've talked about that in multiple episodes of the podcast, I see an over-aggressive use of force that should have never happened in light of the circumstances. The circumstances there did not warrant what I saw. In this case, I think, A, more investigation is needed to see what the officers knew, but also, on its face, the use of force is legally justified. The problem is, for a lot of people, it is very hard to separate what feels legally justified and morally justified. When you see a video of someone shot in the back at very close range, 7 or 8 times, I understand the outrage. I understand the feeling that this can't keep happening, that something has to change. My other perspective on that is, victims should also feel safe in their homes. When there's a restraining order, it should be adhered to. What does it say to domestic violence victims everywhere when the NBA and the MLB are canceling games calling for justice for Jacob Blake? Because what it says to victims everywhere is you can't call the police. At least that's what I think it says. Also, can we talk about the instances of domestic violence in the NBA? Can we just for a minute? Because I feel that when stuff like this happens in this circumstance, the victim gets lost. And I imagine that the public attention puts the victim squarely in a position where they feel shame, or that they feel wrong for having called the police, and that was the right thing to do in these circumstances. And victims shouldn't feel the fear that they feel. But also, what I know about domestic violence cases is that by the time there's a police report and a restraining order, it's not the first time, it's not the second time, it's not the third time. So I really, my heart breaks for the victim in this case, and my heart breaks for his kids that were in the SUV. It's fucking horrifying. But those are choices. Different than like in George Floyd's case. Different than in Breonna Taylor's case. These are three very, very different cases. And I have episodes about them all. And we're going to keep talking about police shootings and the facts surrounding them. Though I hate to see anyone shot, I truly, truly do. This was a case where your choices put you in the position where you ended up. And that's what that is. The choice to violate the restraining order, the choice not to comply with officers, the choice to not stop after you got tased multiple times, and the choice to keep going back into your car when you were told not to. Those choices are part of what led to this. And that is not widely being discussed and needs to be. though anyone should be able to be taken in on a warrant without being shot. And it happens every day. Yes, I understand and I have heard that there is fear of going into police custody. But there has to be a conversation around how to make those two things work. When the police have a legitimate reason to take you into custody, there needs to be greater conversations around making that happen without incident, which it does quite often. So I have tremendous empathy for Jacob Blake's children. I have tremendous empathy for the victim who had the restraining order against him. I have a very hard time with the media making him a hero of some kind, because though the conversation still needs to happen, this is not a case where the police were wrong. So when I see people calling for justice, I really wish they were calling for justice for domestic violence victims on this set of facts. I wish there was a bigger conversation going on around how to call the police safely, how to de-escalate domestic violence situations safely. Those are the conversations that I would like to see happening in light of this police shooting. And then the unrest in Kenosha led to militia activity, which is what Kyle Rittenhouse is. It's militia activity. And the problem is, this is a rough analogy. Grant me some grace here. Twilight. When the vampire army is being raised in Seattle to come and take on Bella and the Cullens, if you haven't watched the Twilight movies or read the Twilight books, I'm sorry, I will explain. And then more of the tribe that Jacob Black is in start turning into wolves, Quileutes. More of them become wolves because they respond to the larger number of vampires in the area. And it's like this escalation of forces on both sides, kind of like a vampire werewolf. Well, they're really shapeshifters, but whatever. Vampire werewolf Cold War, where each side escalates forces. That's what I'm seeing happen somewhere like Kenosha and in Portland. When you have one side rising, there is other side rising to match it. So when you have extremes on either side, and I'm not saying the majority is extreme, I'm saying the minority is extreme. There are minority extremist groups on both sides at this point that are clashing. And it taints the message that needs to be heard. And that's problematic too. And so when you see widespread looting and property damage, you're also going to get a population of Americans that are like, the Second Amendment says it's my right and duty to protect my community. There is a very long statement by Kyle Rittenhouse's lawyers saying that that's what he was doing. If you're not familiar with what the fuck I'm even talking about, Kyle Rittenhouse showed up in Kenosha. Apparently, he's also a lifeguard in Kenosha and had like worked earlier that day. Who knew? And stated that he was protecting property. Again, the video on social media shows him with an AR-15 looking gun. I don't think it's been identified from the police exactly what type of gun it is, but it looks like an AR-15 type of gun from my non-gun expert eyes. And the video shows him shooting. He injured one person and killed two. He's in custody pending murder charges. He's 17 years old. He is not a resident of Wisconsin. He is a resident of Illinois, where he is in custody. His lawyers say that he's going to be fighting extradition to Wisconsin, which, if I was his defense attorney, I'd probably do the exact same thing. So the video of him is him shooting at protesters, though it is clear, and I don't suggest watching any of these videos. It's just, it's tragic all the way around. All of it, all of this is tragic. But it does seem in those videos that he is being chased. However, this is again your choices. He chose to show up after days of protests with a very large military-style weapon, dressed in, like, army green, and rolling around militia style. That was a choice. You're 17 years old. First of all, this is why you have parents to tell you this is a bad idea. Because if you're rolling around after dark with that weapon, you're obviously going to be the target of comments and of anger, of which there is plenty to go around if you read any comments to anything online, ever. So this is a terrible choice. Whether he had the gun legally is still in question. I don't know if it really matters when two people are dead if he had the gun legally. A 17-year-old shouldn't be rolling around with an AR-15 at a protest. But when you have extremes rise on one side, they rise on the other side. And now you have a situation where a 17-year-old has killed two people because he and those like him believe that the government is not doing enough to protect life, liberty, and property. And that's where we're at. That's where we can't all have a conversation. We're at people shooting at people. And the lawyer statements from Kyle definitely share a different narrative than what has been shared. And of course it does, because part of their statement is a PR piece, because that's what you do. But details a very clear argument for self-defense. That is obviously what they are going to go with. I know there are people calling for Kyle Rittenhouse to sit in prison for the rest of his life. Interestingly enough, in California, juveniles can't sit in prison for the rest of their life. It's considered unconstitutional. Though part of that rule frustrates me because I've seen gangs use juveniles to commit drive-by shootings and such, knowing that they'll get less time. Like, that feels calculated. But also acknowledging that the brain's not fully developed at that age, so you do make shitty choices. However, when shitty choices meet very large weaponry and an angry mob, it's a bad situation that didn't have to happen. Like, it's a tragic situation that didn't have to happen. And he put himself in that situation and will go to prison for it. The thing about it is, if there is a valid self-defense claim, it will be a justifiable homicide, and he might not go to prison for that long. It just depends on what the gun charges are, and people will be pissed. So you have these videos on social media of Jacob Blake being shot in the back by police officers, of Kyle Rittenhouse shooting at protesters who are protesting the death of Jacob Blake, and then the video of Kyle Rittenhouse with his hands up walking past police officers as police officers and emergency vehicles are moving into the area where the shooting occurred. That is what I was most curious about, because that seems to be part and a large part of the narrative that, because Kyle Rittenhouse is white, he walks by police with an AR-15 and nobody stops to question him, which is questionable. For sure. And I'm going to explore that in just a moment. And juxtapose that with the video of Jacob Blake getting shot in the back and the argument that, hey, Kyle Rittenhouse is being taken into custody peaceably and Jacob Blake wasn't taken into custody peaceably. I think both of these men's choices, I mean, juvenile in the case of Kyle Rittenhouse, but you know what I mean. Both of these men's choices put them in the circumstances where they were. But the circumstances are so very different because there was an arrest warrant and a previous confrontation with police with regard to Jacob Blake. And with regard to Kyle Rittenhouse, police didn't know by the police department's statements. They didn't know that he had been involved in that shooting. And there are open carry laws in that state that don't make him walking around with this gun immediately alarming. So you have two very different circumstances being juxtaposed against each other. And that is what I find frustrating, because they are different. And the police department has come forward and said there were lots of gunshots that evening. There were lots of people out past the curfew that we were trying to round up. And there were lots of people out armed, protecting businesses or otherwise. So I understand the differences, but I also understand the comparison is coming from underlying frustration and rage and the appearance that you can kill two people and walk past police and it's fine. And you have a domestic violence arrest warrant and you end up shot in the back. I understand that. There's just a lot more to that narrative than a meme or a 30-second clip captures. And hopefully I've been able to kind of talk about those facts. Kyle Rittenhouse has got a very long legal battle in front of him while he is in juvenile custody. It's probably for the best that he's in juvenile custody. I imagine he's isolated in juvenile custody. The thing that's interesting to me, and this gets back to what I started with, is that there is a GoFundMe for Jacob Blake and his six kids. The kids, by the way, in my opinion, should get all of that money, as should his domestic violence victim. But that's my own personal opinion. That's well over $2 million. And there is no doubt he will need medical care. There is no doubt there will be a civil lawsuit against the police department for the injuries, for the shooting. There's no doubt that all those things will happen. Money will be needed for legal, all of it. But when people tried to start a GoFundMe for Kyle Rittenhouse, they were shut down. So when I get to the freedom of speech First Amendment, picking doesn't get to happen. So even though Kyle Rittenhouse, to you, might seem like a vigilante asshole who should just sit in prison for shooting two people, is it the decision of GoFundMe to shut those down? Who gets to make that decision about which case matters? That's where the questioning for me comes in as to, okay, well, I don't agree with vigilante justice. I was a district attorney. Gangs in LA are essentially vigilante justice. They have their own set of rules and territories. I don't agree with it. I don't agree with vigilante justice. I don't. And I'm not trying to make it seem that what Kyle Rittenhouse did was okay. The point is, who gets to decide that somebody violating a protective order who fights with police gets to have a GoFundMe, and somebody who shows up allegedly to protect businesses and gets attacked by a mob and shoots people doesn't get to have a GoFundMe? That's the point that I'm struggling with, because again, that First Amendment doesn't mean you have to agree with it. And that's where I'm struggling, because the like lawyer side of me is like, intellectually, these are different situations and I have thoughts. And then morally, you're just like, God, all of this sucks. And it's tragic, but it also raises a lot of questions about cancel culture, about discourse, and about whether we can even have conversations anymore about differences of opinion, and whether we can have conversations about why are we seeing a rise in vigilante justice? What is the response from government? What is causing, like, what are the cause and effects here? And what is the appropriate response? Because I see the narrative this way. People are mad at police for attempting to arrest on an arrest warrant and a violation of a protective order that resulted in a use of force because he didn't comply with police orders, and are mad that police did their job in that way. But then there's also outrage that Kyle Rittenhouse was not arrested, was not confronted, and walked past police when police were unaware of what had happened and unaware that he was the perpetrator of what had happened. So I understand that the desire is to make the narrative about race. And there is a valid narrative happening around race in this country. These two examples are not the two examples that logically make sense to me, because this is about circumstance, in my opinion, and the surrounding circumstances, more than it is about race. I'm hoping that talking about the surrounding circumstances of these cases particularly will help point out that this is the kind of dialogue that needs to be happening. The dialogue of what are the surrounding circumstances? What are the full stories? What is happening? Instead of fanning the flames. And I feel that there's a lot of that going on all sides of the media. And it's divisive. And I find that very frustrating because we can't, as a country, have the conversations we need to have if the only narrative being pushed is to divide us. And that is what I am finding so frustrating. And that is what I am struggling with, because it seems to me to be a grasping at these two circumstances to make a narrative happen when there are plenty of valid conversations to have around what is happening in America right now and around race in America. But these two circumstances are not what's being portrayed fully, right? These two circumstances are not as the news is reporting them. Thank you for hanging with me through this conversation. These are conversations that need to continue to happen. We need to continue to call out things as we see them, even when we disagree, in a passionate but kind way, because it's the only way I can see that we can actually make something different come of all of this. It was also a heartbreaking weekend with the passing of actor Chadwick Boseman, who did so much to uplift and to bring Black stories to the big screen, to popular culture, to allow kids to see themselves in film. And I hope that as we, as a country, reflect, and I don't think it's just a U.S. discussion, I think this is discussion that is happening in other countries as well. I know it is. I've seen the protests on TV too. But I hope that the message of uplifting stories, sharing experiences, and listening to each other with compassion is what we start to take away and demand better than divisive memes meant to keep us afraid of each other, afraid of speaking our minds. We already have enough to be afraid of, people. I mean, between COVID and all the other shit that is 2020, we all have more than our fair share of fear right now. Media fear-mongering is not it. And I'm so frustrated. And I know you are too. And I know this is a heavy episode. And thank you for hanging with me. Thank you for being willing to listen to this conversation, for making up your mind for yourself, and for having the conversation with me if you want to. My DMs are always open, with no judgment, on Instagram at the Emily D. Baker, and in our Facebook group, which I moderate heavily to keep it no judgment, because there will not be fighting. Conversation, yes. Fighting, no. And that's the Get Legit community on Facebook. All of it's linked below. I appreciate you. We've got some more heavy stuff we're going to have to get through in the next few weeks. So buckle up, because September and October are going to be real. There's going to be a lot happening, and we're going to talk about it. So I'll talk to you next week. And because we're still in the middle of a pandemic, may your Wi-Fi be strong. May your toilet paper be plentiful. May your family be well. And may the odds be ever in your favor. I'll talk to you next week, friend. Guess what? We are coming up on episode 50 of the Get Legit Law and Shit podcast. I can't believe it either. But for episode 50, I'm going to do a special Q&A just for the listeners. So if you have a question, keep an eye on my Instagram stories and the Get Legit community on Facebook, because I will be giving you a way to ask me the questions you want to ask, whether it's about business, about law, about current events, or about me. I mean, it's all fair game. So shoot me a question, include your name, and I will be answering those on episode 50 of the Get Legit Law and Shit podcast. See you soon, friend.